Extend, pretend, foreclose, the commercial real estate collapse. The framework predicted is operationally here. In October 2025, an investor named Mark Calabria purchased a long vacant 8-story office building at 401 South State Street in Chicago's Loop for $4.2 million. The building had last traded in 2016 at $68.1 million. The price declined 94%. By February 2026, Calabria had a stated plan with the vertical farming firm Farm Zero to convert the building into an urban farming and food innovation campus, a use case that requires substantial physical reconfiguration of the structure, but no longer requires the building to function as the Class B office property it was originally designed to be. In September 2025, an investor named Asher Luzzatto bought the two-building Denver Energy Center at $1,625 and $1,675 Broadway for $5.25 million. The 900,000-square-foot complex, 18% occupied, had traded at $176 million in 2013. The price declined 97%. In Washington, D.C., in March 2026, Hossein Fateh's Dalian Development bought the former GSA Regional Office Building at 301 7th Street SW, 940,000 square feet, vacant since the Department of Homeland Security left in March 2025 for $24.3 million, just over $25 per square foot. In San Francisco, in February 2026, an affiliate of CW Capital Asset Management acquired the bottom 8 floors of 1155 Market Street at a foreclosure auction for $4 million against the $48 million CMBS loan secured by them. These are not anomalous transactions. They are the visible surface of a much broader pattern that is now operationally arriving in commercial real estate after 3 years of extend and pretend. The term of art for the strategy by which lenders and borrowers cooperated to defer recognition of losses by extending maturing loans and modifying terms rather than forcing default or sale. The strategy worked, in the limited sense that it kept reported delinquency rates lower than the underlying credit quality warranted, while everyone waited for interest rates to fall and for office demand to recover. Interest rates did not fall enough. Office demand did not recover enough. By the start of 2026, the strategy was no longer viable for an increasing share of the affected loans. And the cascade now visible in the data is the institutional manifestation of that exhaustion. This essay is the 11th installment of Watching the Cracks. It does three things. First, it documents the specific empirical events of 2026 that demonstrate the cascade is operationally here. Named properties, specific transactions, specific loan modifications. Second, it engages extend and pretend as a structural mechanism by showing how the practice produces directly observable distortions in the published CMBS delinquency time series. Third, it locates the cascade's downstream risk in the regional banking sector, which holds approximately 70% of U.S. CRE loans against approximately 5% held by the largest banks. A concentration that means the eventual recognition of losses will flow primarily through the institutions least equipped to absorb them. The framework's broader catalog has been making this argument since Article 16, FDIC Banking Diagnostics, and Article 19, the Tax Plus Insurance Wedge, applied to housing. The 2026 data validates the prediction trajectory with the kind of specific empirical detail that has, throughout this catalog, distinguish the framework's analytical posture from the conventional discussion. A note on framing before proceeding. The CRE cascade is now widely discussed in financial press. The data this essay engages is publicly available. What the framework adds is the structural reading, the connection between the visible transactions and the underlying substrate fragility thesis. The catalog has been developing across 26 prior essays. Reporters cover the fire sales. Analysts cover the delinquency rates. What neither tends to do is connect both to the broader monetary architectural pattern the framework has been documenting. That connection is the analytical work this essay does. The two-mode market. The 2026 commercial office market is clearing in two operationally distinct modes simultaneously, and the distinction matters for understanding what is happening structurally. Mode 1 is forced clearing. properties whose lenders have lost patience with the extend and pretend strategy, or whose ownership structures cannot survive further deferral, are being sold at prices that reflect the underlying credit quality of the asset rather than the carrying value on lender balance sheets. The 401 South State Street transaction in Chicago is canonical. $68.1 million in 2016, $4.2 million in October 2025. A 94% decline. The Denver Energy Center, $176 million in 2013, $5.25 million in September 2025, 97%. The San Francisco, 1,155 market floors cleared at $4 million against the $48 million loan secured by them. A recovery of 8 cents on the dollar of debt, which is a different measurement from the other two and worth keeping distinct. The Washington, D.C. sale is different again, a federal surplus disposition rather than a distressed private trade with no public prior appraisal to measure against, which is why the framework reports it as $25 per square foot for a 940,000 square foot building rather than as a percentage loss. MSCI counted more than 200 distressed office sales in 2025, up from 133 in 2023 and totaling $5.2 billion. The pace accelerated further into 2026. What distinguishes Mode 1 transactions is that the buyers do not plan to operate the buildings in their original use. Calabria's Urban Farming and Food Innovation Center is not an unusual concept. It is the typical structure of the Mode 1 transaction. The buyer is acquiring the physical structure at a price that allows them to absorb the cost of converting it to a use that the current market actually wants. Typically, residential conversion where regulations permit, light industrial or makerspace use where the building's structural characteristics support it, or specialty uses, urban agriculture, medical, education, where the location provides an advantage. The framework's reading, Mode 1 transactions, are the saleability discovery process operating without the substitute layer of lender forbearance. The buyer pays what the asset is worth in its physically deliverable form, not what the prior monetary regime's pricing infrastructure said it was worth. The marquee loans, the ones whose magnitudes are large enough that institutional considerations dominate the disposition decision, remain in extend and pretend status. Worldwide Plaza in Manhattan, $940 million loan, has been in and out of special servicing since September 2024, was modified in March 2025, and by 2026 had drawn a $940 million foreclosure suit from its senior lenders, but has still not been resolved through sale. One New York Plaza, $835 million, went to special servicing in December 2025 and was modified and extended to January 9, 2028. Kicked. Exactly 2 years down the road against a $25 million principal paydown and a $20 million leasing reserve. The U.S. Steel Tower in Pittsburgh, $245 million of total debt, $160 million of it securitized, was sent to special servicing in March 2026, ahead of a June maturity, but has not been forced into sale. Most notably, 628th Avenue, the former New York Times building, whose upper portion carries a $515 million mortgage, was extended 5 times in 12-month increments from an original December 2020 maturity, and in November 2025 ran out of extensions. The loan matured without payoff and went to special servicing. Each extension was technically legal under the loan documentation. Each extension was also a deferral of the same loss recognition event that the Mode 1 transactions are now executing. And 628th Avenue is what the end of the deferral runway looks like. The framework's central observation, these two modes are operating on the same underlying asset class, in the same economic environment, often in the same metropolitan areas, with the disposition outcomes determined primarily by the size of the loan and the institutional considerations of the lenders involved. Smaller loans on Class B properties owned by relatively smaller borrowers get marked to market and sold at 90% plus losses. Larger loans on marquee properties owned by relatively larger borrowers get modified, extended, and held at carrying values that bear no relationship to the prices the same buildings would fetch in a sale. This is not market efficiency. This is institutional dispensation, operating to protect specific balance sheet positions, while the broader market clears around the protected loans. The data itself shows the mechanism. What makes the 2026 CRE situation analytically unusual is that the extend and pretend mechanism is directly observable in the published CMBS delinquency time series. The framework rarely gets to point at a single data series and say the manipulation is happening in this number, you can see it, but in this case, the structure of the data is itself the evidence. In January 2026, the TREP CMBS overall delinquency rate hit 7.47%, with office delinquency at 12.34%, an all-time high. In February 2026, the overall rate dropped 33 basis points to 7.14%, and office delinquency fell 114 basis points to 11.20%. The decline was not the result of borrower performance improving. It was the result, per TREP's own reporting, of the execution of modifications and extensions of five large matured office loans and four large mall loans, with office extensions ranging from 1 month to almost 3 years. In March 2026, the overall rate increased 41 basis points to 7.55% as the same pattern continued, newly delinquent loans pushing the rate back up, while modifications and extensions pulled it back down. TREP's analysts described the dynamic explicitly, a sideways delinquency trend, as loans mature, go delinquent, cure, and become delinquent again. Roughly 40% of March's newly delinquent loans were classified as performing matured balloon the prior month, meaning loans that had reached maturity, been extended in some technical form to remain classified as performing, then crossed back into delinquency when the extension proved insufficient. The framework reads this pattern carefully. The published delinquency rate is not a measure of how many loans are in genuine distress. It is a measure of how many loans are in distress that the special servicers have chosen not to modify within the reporting period. The same loan can cycle in and out of delinquent status multiple times across consecutive months as modifications are executed, then fail, then be remodified, then fail again. The 12.34% January office delinquency reading and the 11.20% February reading do not represent improving credit conditions. They represent the same underlying pool of distressed loans being processed through different administrative classifications at different reporting dates. The implication: the published delinquency rate substantially understates the actual credit stress in the CMBS office sector. Franz Hinsen, Felipe Severino, and Stijn van Nieuwenbroek, in Too Many to Ignore, Regional Banks and CRE Risks, 2025, built a loan-level data set from county records and found that reported delinquencies understate risks from under-collateralized loans by a factor of four. The formal academic confirmation of what the time series oscillations make visible at the surface. Their factor of four is measured on bank-held CRE loans, not on CMBS, and the framework does not claim the two data sets are interchangeable. But applied as the framework's own extrapolation to the published 11.20% February office CMBS delinquency rate, it implies underlying stress in the 40-45% range. That is a framework estimate rather than a finding of the research, and it is offered as the rough magnitude of the office sector's problem masked by the modification machinery, the named properties, and what they tell us. The named distressed properties of 2026 are worth examining individually because each one contains structural information about the broader pattern. Worldwide Plaza, 49th Street, Manhattan. The $940 million CMBS loan first went to special servicing in September 2024, when the anchor tenant Cravath, Swain & Moore vacated its 617,000 square feet for Brookfield's 2 Manhattan West and left the tower 63% occupied. A 2025 appraisal cut $1.4 billion from the building's 2017 valuation. The building is approximately 1.6 million square feet of Class A office space within a 2 million square foot complex. The framework's reading: this is a marquee Manhattan address with high quality tenants. Exactly the kind of asset that the recovery thesis Class A will be fine. Only Class B is in trouble, said would not require special servicing. Its appearance in distress is empirical evidence that the recovery thesis is structurally incomplete. 1 New York Plaza, Whitehall Street, Manhattan. The $835 million CMBS loan went to special servicing on December 18, 2025, 3 weeks before its January 9, 2026 maturity, and was modified with the maturity extended to January 9, 2028. Brookfield paid down $25 million of principal and funded a $20 million leasing reserve. Two further one-year options require another $20 million each. The building is a 50-story, roughly 2.5 million square foot Class A tower in Lower Manhattan, fully occupied in 2022 and 83% occupied by late 2025. The 2028 extension is the canonical Mode 2 transaction, kicked the disposition decision 2 years forward into an environment that is hoped to be more favorable. The framework's prediction, the 2028 extension, will not resolve the underlying credit problem, and the loan will either require further extension at that point or be sold under conditions that produce substantial losses for the lender. The extend and pretend timeline has shifted from wait 2 years for the market to improve to wait another 2 years. 628th Avenue, former New York Times building. The $515 million mortgage on the upper portion of the 52-story tower was extended 5 times in 12-month increments from its original December 2020. Maturity reached the end of its extension options in December 2025 and went to special servicing in November 2025 ahead of that date. The restructuring under discussion covers roughly $750 million, including additional debt. The ownership is split. The Times owns the base through the 27th floor, and the upper floors came to Brookfield through its 2018 acquisition of Forest City, the building's original co-developer, not through a purchase from the newspaper. The Times owns sale was of floors 2 through 21 to W.P. Carey in 2009 for about $225 million, with a 10-year leaseback. The framework's reading, a 5-extension property, is, structurally, a property the lender does not believe can be sold without producing a meaningful loss. The continued extension is the lender admitting the structural reality while declining to recognize it in their financial statements. This is the specific operational form of capital erosion that the framework's broader Facchetta-derived analysis has been identifying across multiple sectors. U.S. Steel Tower, Pittsburgh. The $245 million debt package 601W companies used to refinance the tower in 2021, $160 million securitized, $40 million unsecuritized subordinate, $45 million mezzanine, was sent to special servicing in March 2026 ahead of a June maturity. After 4 late interest payments beginning in April 2025, the building is the tallest in Pittsburgh at 2.3 million square feet, and the leases of its 2 anchor tenants, the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center and U.S. Steel itself, expire within 2 years. Pittsburgh is not New York or San Francisco. The regional CRE markets in second-tier metros face structurally different dynamics, with shallower tenant pools and longer recovery timelines. The framework's reading, the appearance of the U.S. Steel Tower in special servicing, is consistent with the catalog's Article 17 Metro Saleability Analysis. Second-tier metros face different stress timelines, but ultimately face the same structural problem, with the institutional substitute layer, special servicing, modification, extension, operating identically across geographies. Brookfield DTLA Portfolio. Brookfield and its lenders are working to offload 4 office buildings, totaling about 4.9 million square feet of Class A, space in downtown Los Angeles, roughly 18% of the financial district submarket's inventory, and nearly a fifth of its Class A space. The framework's reading, when a single institutional owner is exiting 18% of a metro's downtown office inventory, the metro's office market is not in cyclical adjustment. It is undergoing structural reconfiguration. The buyers of these buildings will either be conversion specialists, residential, mixed use, or will be opportunistic capital pools willing to operate at substantially reduced rents that reflect the actual demand environment rather than the pre-2020 pricing infrastructure. The regional banking concentration. The most consequential framework observation about the CRE cascade concerns where the losses will eventually flow. The 2026 fire sales are clearing through CMBS structures, where institutional investors, pension funds, insurance companies, opportunistic credit funds bear the losses through the securitization mechanisms. But CMBS represents only one part of the broader CRE financing picture, and the larger part is held directly by banks. Small and mid-sized banks hold roughly 70% of bank-held U.S. CRE loans, a narrower claim than 70% of all CRE debt, since banks hold only about half of the total. Hinsen, Severino, and Van Nierbra put almost a third of all U.S. commercial mortgage dollars on regional bank balance sheets. The concentration difference is the point. CRE runs around an eighth of the largest banks' loan books and closer to two-fifths at smaller regional banks, with banks in the $1 billion to $10 billion range carrying the largest direct CRE exposure of any size cohort. Under the interagency concentration guidance, a bank whose total CRE loans exceed 300% of total risk-based capital and have grown 50% or more over the preceding 36 months is flagged for heightened supervisory analysis, a screening criterion rather than a limit, and one many regional banks meet. The framework's reading, the eventual recognition of CRE losses will flow primarily through the regional banking sector, which is structurally less equipped to absorb the losses than the larger institutions that dominate financial press coverage. The Hinsen, Severino, and Van Nierbra research is explicit about this. The regional banks are already lowering lending standards to roll over distressed loans, meaning they are extending CRE loans on increasingly aggressive terms to avoid the recognition events that would impair their capital positions. This is the same extend and pretend dynamic visible in the CMBS data, but operating at the bank level where the consequences flow to depositors, FDIC, insured up to $250,000, and to bank holding company shareholders. The catalog's Article 16 FDIC Banking Diagnostics made three specific predictions about the Q1 2026 quarterly banking profile. Problem bank list at 62 to 66 banks. Unrealized losses in the $310 to $340 billion range, and CRE delinquencies at or above the Q4 2025 reading on a bank-held basis, with the closing condition that none of these readings should improve materially from Q4 2025. The release, published May 27, 2026, scored one of the three. Unrealized losses on securities came in at $325.1 billion, up $19.0 billion on the quarter, inside the predicted band. The other two went the other way. The problem bank list fell by six to 54 institutions against a prediction of 62 to 66 and a continuation of the 57-60 trend. The industry's past due and non-accrual rate declined to 1.53% from 1.56%, and the non-owner occupied CRE rate at banks above $250 billion in assets eased to 3.40%, its sixth consecutive quarterly decline. Two of the three readings improved. The framework's intellectual discipline requires stating that plainly rather than reading the release as a validation. What the MIST does and does not establish is worth being precise about. The two readings that improved are the ones most directly shaped by supervisory and accounting discretion. A problem bank list is a count of supervisory ratings, and a past due rate is a count of loans a servicer has not yet modified. That is the same mechanism this essay has just documented in the CMBS series, operating one layer up. It is also exactly what a genuine improvement would look like from the outside, and the framework does not get to have it both ways in the same quarter. The next several quarters of quarterly banking profile data will continue to test the catalog's predictions, and the framework's posture remains what it has been throughout. Descriptive of the structural conditions, attentive to the specific data series that reflect them, and honest about which predictions hold versus which require revision. On this release, one held and two did not. The urban doom loop and the fiscal dimension. The CRE collapse has fiscal consequences that extend well beyond the affected lenders and property owners. Major U.S. cities depend substantially on commercial property tax revenue to fund municipal services, police, schools, transit, infrastructure maintenance. The urban doom loop is Stijna Van Nieuwenberg's coinage from the Columbia and NYU Stern work on remote employment and office valuations he and Arpit Gupta published as Work from Home and the Office Real Estate Apocalypse, since carried by the American Economic Review. Falling office property tax assessments produce lower municipal revenue, which forces service cuts, which reduce urban quality of life, which accelerate the migration of residents and businesses to alternatives, which further depresses property values, which further reduces tax revenue. The mechanism is partly operational, and the fiscal leg of it has moved more slowly than the mechanism implies. office vacancies and sale prices have gone where the research predicted. While the hit to city finances has so far been more muted than the loop's logic would suggest, distressed CRE owners are increasingly filing tax assessment appeals, demanding that their tax bills be lowered to match their now impaired property values. The 411 South State Street building in Chicago, sold at $4 million in 2026, was previously assessed at a value substantially higher than its sale price. The new owner has standing to appeal the assessment downward, which they will. Cities will resist the assessment reductions because their budgets depend on the higher values, but the legal precedent for valuation following market price is well established, and the eventual resolution will produce meaningful municipal revenue losses across multiple major U.S. cities. The framework's broader catalog has engaged this dimension through the housing analysis, Article 17 to 19, particularly the tax plus insurance wedge work. The fiscal dimension of the CRE collapse extends the same pattern to the commercial side, the property tax assessment regime, which has historically functioned as a relatively stable revenue source for municipal governments, is now subject to revaluation pressure from both directions, commercial buildings demanding lower assessments based on sale prices, residential homeowners in stressed metros demanding the same. The framework's prediction: major U.S. cities will face budget deficits and potential credit rating downgrades through 2026 to 2027 as the assessment revaluations work through municipal balance sheets. Boston, New York, San Francisco, Chicago, and Los Angeles are particularly exposed because of their high prior reliance on commercial property tax revenue. What this means for the broader monetary architecture? The framework's broader thesis throughout this catalog has been that monetary architecture in 2026 has accumulated substrate fragility visible across multiple disparate sectors when subjected to specific empirical tests. The CRE collapse is the latest sector to produce visible empirical validation, and it deserves explicit connection to the broader pattern. The substrate that supported the post-2008 CRE expansion was the combination of low interest rates, Federal Reserve policy from 2008 through 2022, and the institutional infrastructure that translated low rates into broadly available CRE financing, CMBS, securitization, regional bank lending, life insurance company allocations, commercial bank participations. When interest rates rose sharply through 2022 to 2024, the underlying property values supported by the prior low-rate environment became structurally inconsistent with the new financing environment. The institutional infrastructure responded by deferring recognition, extend, and pretend, rather than forcing immediate revaluation. The deferral worked for 3 years. It is no longer working in 2026. This is structurally analogous to what the catalog has documented in other sectors. Banking, Article 16. The FDIC failure count masking substantial underlying stress through similar deferral mechanisms. Housing, Articles 17 to 19. The metro-level saleability heterogeneity hidden by national aggregates with the tax-plus insurance wedge-breaking household budgets in specific geographies. Precious metals, Article 24. Paper physical decoupling under stress with the January 30 silver crash demonstrating the substrate. Failure operationally. Cryptocurrency, Article 25. The Iran seizures demonstrating the substitute layer enforcement reach extending into ostensibly decentralized instruments. Supply chains, Article 26. The Hormuz disruption propagating through buffer-depleted reserves on calendar time mechanics. The CRE collapse fits this pattern precisely. The substrate that supported the prior pricing structure has failed. The institutional substitute layer extend and pretend, special servicing, modification, has deferred but not prevented the recognition. The cascade is now operationally visible in specific named transactions and specific bank exposure concentrations. The framework's reading: the cumulative weight of substrate fragility evidence across sectors is now substantial enough that the broader thesis no longer requires defense. It requires only continued application as additional sectors produce additional empirical validation. What households should take from this? The framework's specific operational observations for household readers: regional bank exposure deserves direct examination. Households with substantial deposits at regional banks, $1 billion to $50 billion in total assets, should examine the specific bank's CRE concentration. The data is publicly available through the Federal Financial Institutions Examination Council's call report system. Total CRE loans above 300% of total risk-based capital, combined with 50% growth over 3 years. Is the interagency criterion that flags a bank for closer supervisory analysis? Banks with such concentrations are not immediately at risk of failure. They are, however, structurally exposed in ways that the framework's reading suggests will produce meaningful capital pressure over the next 18 to 36 months. FDIC insurance covers deposits up to $250,000 per depositor per insured bank per ownership category. Households whose deposits exceed the insurance threshold should consider distributing across institutions. Municipal credit exposure matters for fixed income holdings. Households holding municipal bonds for major cities with high commercial property tax dependence, Boston, New York, San Francisco, Chicago, Los Angeles, should review the specific issuer's revenue diversification and rainy day fund positions. The urban doom loop is a multi-year process, not a single event. Meaningful credit deterioration is likely over the next 24 to 36 months in the most exposed municipalities. The framework does not advise specific allocation decisions, but the structural exposure is worth understanding before it becomes news rather than analysis. REIT exposure may be repricing for some time. Publicly traded office, REITs, have substantially repriced over the past several years, but the framework's reading is that the repricing has not fully absorbed the extend and pretend distortions visible in the underlying CMBS data. Households with REIT exposure through retirement accounts or general portfolios should understand that the office subsector specifically faces continued downside as the substitute layer mechanisms. Exhaust further. Other CRE subsectors, industrial, multifamily, data centers, are operating under different supply-demand conditions and should not be evaluated as a single class with office. The framework's broader case for taking substrate fragility seriously continues to strengthen. The CRE collapse is the latest sector to produce visible empirical validation of the catalog's structural thesis. Households making long-term financial decisions should price the cumulative weight of the evidence accordingly. The framework's standard guidance, physical assets with direct saleability, geographic diversification of exposure, attention to specific institutional concentrations, awareness of where in the financial architecture's asymmetric support structure the household sits, continues to apply. The closing observation. Beginning with his 1957 work on money market changes, the economist Hyman Minsky developed what would later be called the financial instability hypothesis. The observation that periods of economic stability systematically incentivize the accumulation of financial fragility. Until the cumulative fragility exceeds the system's absorptive capacity and produces what Paul McCulley, not Minsky, would name a Minsky moment. 4 decades later, during the 1998 Russian default, the sudden recognition that asset prices that had been sustained by leverage and short-term financing arrangements were not actually justified by underlying cash flows. The post-2008 monetary architecture was, in Minsky's vocabulary, designed to produce exactly the conditions he warned about: extended periods of low interest rates that incentivized leveraged accumulation, institutional substitute layers, the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, agency MBS, central bank standing facilities that allowed the accumulated leverage to operate longer than market conditions would have permitted, and a regulatory framework that discouraged forced recognition of losses in favor of extended workout periods. The CRE collapse is, in framework terms, the slow-motion Minsky moment in commercial real estate specifically. The accumulated fragility was real. The recognition is no longer fully deferrable. The transactions clearing at 76 to 97% losses from prior values are the market discovering what the buildings are actually worth under current financing conditions and current demand conditions. The marquee loans still in extend and pretend are the institution's buying time for the eventual recognition events. The regional banks holding 70% of the broader CRE exposure are the substrate that will absorb the losses when the recognition events arrive. None of this required a single sudden crisis to produce. It required only that the accumulated substrate fragility eventually exceed the system's absorptive capacity through the slow grind of expired extensions, exhausted patients, and individual properties whose specific economics made further deferral impossible. The transactions of 2026 are the visible early phase of that process. The framework's prediction is that 2026 to 2028 will see continued recognition across the CRE sector, with the cumulative magnitude of recognized losses ultimately running far above the published delinquency figures. The framework's own extrapolation from the Hinzen factor of 4, not a finding of that research. Watching the cracks will engage the May 2026 CPI release that drops Wednesday, June 10, 3 days from this essay's publication in Article 29. The framework's Article 26 made specific predictions about the Hormuz supply shock propagation timeline. The May print is the first major data point that should reflect meaningful Hormuz transmission per the framework's calendar mechanics. Whatever it shows, confirming the framework's prediction trajectory or surprising it, will be engaged honestly. The pattern of substrate fragility validation continues to accumulate across sectors. The framework's posture continues to be what it has been throughout this catalog, descriptive of structural conditions, attentive to specific empirical signals, and honest about what the cumulative evidence reveals. The collapse is here. The watching continues. This is the 11th installment of Watching the Cracks. The framework's predictions recorded here for future testing, 2026 to 2028, will see continued CRE loss recognition with cumulative magnitudes far above the published delinquency figures. On the framework's own 40 to 45% extrapolation from the Hinzen factor of 4, rather than a finding of that research. Regional banks past the 300% of risk-based capital concentration criterion will face meaningful capital pressure through this window. Major U.S. cities with high commercial property tax dependence will face budget deficits and potential credit rating downgrades through 2026 to 2027, the 600 and 28th Avenue. 1 NY Plaza class of extend and pretend loans will require further extension or produce substantial loss recognition events when their current modifications expire. The fire sale chart at the top of this essay shows actual 2026 transactions on the left and outstanding loan balances in extend and pretend status on the right. Sources include The Real Deal, Wall Street Journal, San Francisco Business Journal, TREP CMBS data, and the FDIC Q1 2026 quarterly banking profile. Sources: the prediction this essay tests. Article 16 recorded three forecasts for the Q1 2026 FDIC data. Two missed. The problem bank list came in at 54, down 6 on the quarter against a predicted 62 to 66, and CRE delinquency fell rather than holding at or above the prior reading, with total loan PDNA at 1.53% from 1.56% and non-owner-occupied CRE at the largest banks at 3.40%, a sixth consecutive quarterly decline. One held unrealized losses at $325.1 billion, up $19.0 billion inside the predicted $310 to $340 billion range. FDIC quarterly banking profile. The named transactions: 401 South State Street, Chicago, sold October 2025 for $4.2 million against $68.1 million in 2016, a 93.8% decline. The buyer is Mark Calabria, and the vertical farming conversion with Farm Zero was announced the following February 2026. The building is the 1891 Jenny, designed former Siegel, Cooper & Co. store. The essay had the sale in April 2026 at $4 million. Denver Energy Center, 1,625 and 1,675 Broadway, September 2025, $5.25 million. 900,000 square feet at 18% occupancy against $176 million in 2013, a 97% decline. The essay had it around the same time at $5.3 million. GSA, Regional Office Building, 3017 SW, Washington, Hossein Fateh's Dalian Development, March 2026. $24.26 million for 940,000 square feet, just over $25 a square foot in a federal surplus sale. Vacant since DHS left in March 2025. No prior appraisal exists on the public record, so the SA's 76% loss against a $100 million valuation has been withdrawn. The price per square foot carries the point. 1155 Market Street, San Francisco. A CW Capital affiliate took the bottom 8 floors at a February 2026 foreclosure auction for $4 million against a $48 million CMBS loan, figures verified. But this is a recovery against debt, not a decline from a prior sale price like the other three, and the basis is now distinguished in both text and chart. MSCI. More than 200 distressed office sales in 2025, up from 133 in 2023, totaling $5.2 billion. Worldwide Plaza went to special servicing in September 2024, when Cravath's 617,000 sq-ft lease expired and the tower fell to 63% occupied. It was modified in March 2025. A 2025 appraisal cut $1.4 billion from the 2017 value, and senior lenders filed a $940 million foreclosure suit in 2026. The SA had it sent to special servicing in early 2026, which is 2 years late. One New York Plaza, $835 million. Special servicing, 18 December 2025, 3 weeks before 9 January 2026 maturity, extended to 9. January 2028 against a $25 million paydown and a $20 million leasing reserve with 2 further one-year options at $20 million each. Roughly 2.5 million sq-ft across 50 stories, fully occupied in 2022 and 83% by late 2025. 628th Avenue, 5 12-month extensions from a December 2020 maturity, exhausted in December 2025, with the loan and special servicing from November 2025, and a restructuring covering roughly $750 million, including additional debt. The SA is still deferring. Framing has been corrected to the exhaustion. Its ownership history was wrong on all 3 points. Brookfield came in via its 2018 acquisition of Forest City, the original co-developer, and The Times sold floors 2-21 to W.P. Carey in 2009 for about $225 million with a 10-year leaseback. Not to Brookfield in 2007 for $525 million. U.S. Steel Tower, a $245 million 2021 debt package, $160 million securitized, $40 million unsecuritized subordinate, $45 million mezzanine. Transferred to special servicing in March 2026 ahead of a June 2026 maturity after 4 late interest payments from April 2025, 2.3 million ISQ-FT. With U.S. Steel, and the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center as anchors, both leases expiring within 2 years. Brookfield DTLA, 4 active offerings, about 4.9 million sq-ft of Class A, roughly 18% of the financial district submarket, and nearly a fifth of its Class A space. The TREP series. TREP, January 2026, overall 7.47%, plus 17 BP in office, 12.34%, plus 103 BP, an all-time high. February, overall 7.14%, 33 BP in office, 11.20%, Deeple C, 114 BP. March, overall 7.55%, plus 41 BP, and office 11.71%, plus 51 BP. TREP attributed the February drop to a net decrease in delinquent balance, primarily driven by the execution of modifications and extensions of 5 large matured office loans and 4 large mall loans, and described a sideways delinquency trend as loans mature, go delinquent, cure, and become delinquent again, both verbatim. 1 month was misassigned, roughly 40% of newly delinquent loans classified as performing matured balloon. The prior month is March's figure against February, not February's against January. The under-collateralization multiple. Franz Hinzen and Felipe Severino Tuck, with Stijnin van Nieuwenberg Columbia. Too many to ignore. Regional banks and CRE risks, hosted by Wharton's Financial Regulation Initiative, which is why the SA had the affiliations wrong. Reported delinquencies understate risks from undercollateralized loans by a factor of 4, verbatim, from a loan-level data set built out of county records. Measured on bank-held CRE loans, applying it to a CMBS delinquency rate, is this framework's extrapolation and is labeled as such here, and in both CODA restatements.